Welcome back to the podcast. Today, I got to have a conversation with Ken Priebe, who is an animator, stop motion animator. He's also written several books, two of which include The Art of Stop Motion Animation and The Advanced Art of Stop Motion Animation. He's also a hand-drawn animator, and he's gotten to do some projects with Scholastic and others. I had a lot of questions about stop motion animation, having never done it myself. And it was fun to get to ask all of those questions and get them all answered. So I hope you will enjoy this conversation and learn as much as I did.
I kind of got bit by the animation bug during college. I grew up in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and went to University of Michigan in Ann Arbor after high school. And wasn't really 100% sure what I wanted to do when I was there, but I started taking film classes. And around the same time that I started taking film classes, Wallace and Gromit's short film, The Wrong Trousers, came on television quite randomly. And I had seen stop motion before, like I knew what it was. I grew up with the California Raisins commercials. And the first time I'd ever seen stop motion actually being done was when I was like 5 or 6. And I saw a behind the scenes TV special about The Empire Strikes Back. And how they did the animate stop motion effects in that. And so I always kind of knew what it was and how it was done. But when I saw Wallace and Gromit and Nightmare Before Christmas had come out more or less in the same breath that same year. And it kind of got, because I had the opportunity to actually take film classes and actually, you know, work with cameras that which do stop frame, I kind of thought, you know, I should really try this because I like to draw. I like to sculpt. I like to do voices. I like music. I love film and art. And so for me, it was at that time, it was kind of a way to put everything together. So I kind of fell in love with animation while I was there. And they didn't really teach animation formally. I did take a couple animation courses, which were really more digital animation classes. But I did an independent study. I made my own short film with live action and clay animation together. And then a local animator named Steve Stanchfield hired me to work with him as a summer job. He was doing animation for a company called Media Station, and they were doing CD-ROM games for kids. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't stop motion. It was all hand-drawn, like little, you know, animations. So then after that, I decided I wanted to do this, you know, more, and moved out to Vancouver because they had a 1-year animation program at a place called Van Arts. And at the time it was just an animation school. And I did hand-drawn classical 2D animation for a year. And then I got the opportunity to make a short film there. And there was this new software called Stop Motion Pro, which had just come out, and it allowed you to shoot the stop motion digitally, in where the frames would be stored in the computer as opposed to on film, which is how I had learned it. And so one thing led to another. And then someone at the school said, you know, some of the other animation students want to learn what you're doing with this stop motion stuff. Would you be interested in offering a workshop? So I did that. And that grew into a part-time course, which I taught there for many years. And then that led to a publisher contacting me and asking me if I might want to write a book, a textbook about stop motion. And then a few years later, they wanted a follow-up, like a volume 2, like an advanced volume. And then I got to teach stop motion at a couple different colleges as well, at Academy of Art University. And more recently, I've taught stop motion at Emily Carr University here in Vancouver a couple summers. Most of the commercial work that I've done has actually been hand-drawn animation.
He slips and slides on a banana peel. He lands on the pillow.
My background and experience in stop motion has mostly come from teaching and the student films that I did, you know, ages ago. So I've done a lot of stop motion courses for grownups and also for kids. I've done stop motion workshops for kids many years for now, which has been a lot of fun. But I've also done a lot of hand-drawn animated films for a buddy of mine named Galen Fott, who runs a studio called Big Fott Studios. And he directs animated shorts for Weston Woods, which are all children's books. So most of my work that I've done more professionally has been 2D animation, but stop motion is sort of the other medium that I do dabble with occasionally.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's fun. You mentioned Weston Woods. That's a new name in our home. My son, he's three. And so we've gotten these little DVDs and I'll see that kind of name come up and I'm like, oh, interesting. I wonder who that is. Fun.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think stop motion animation is kind of a different form of animation. Were you particularly drawn to stop motion animation or has a lot of the teaching opportunities and things been sort of more happenstance? Like kind of, is there a particular draw to stop motion?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a draw to it. I mean, the draw to it, I think, comes from, you know, like I said, growing up with it a lot. The earliest stop motion I ever saw was probably on Sesame Street and Nickelodeon and stuff. And of course, Star Wars, without even realizing it was stop motion until I saw on TV how they did it. I think the draw to it that people have has a lot to do with the fact that it is, that we, you know, it's like we grow up playing with action figures and dolls and Play-Doh and making things with your hands, you know, if you're lucky. And if you have, you know, a lot of arts and crafts stuff as a kid that you do in school and stuff. And then, you know, we all play with dolls and imagine little scenarios, whether it be dinosaurs or, you know, whatever. And so we have that sort of memory in the back of our head of like, this is what it feels like to touch a little tiny figure and make it wiggle around and pretend that it's alive, which is a lot kind of like puppetry. It's the same thing as putting a sock on your hand and doing, you know, a sock puppet. So we all have that memory in the back of our head and we remember what it felt like and what it felt like in our fingers. And so when you watch a stop motion film, I think in the back of your head, everybody kind of has an idea of how it's done. But the fact that these characters are moving on their own without the animator's hands actually in the frame, but they were actually in the frame in those moments between all the pictures that they took, between the frames, right? So I think that that's where, on a kind of a spiritual and psychological level, I think that's where the draw and the pull to stop motion tends to come from. I think there's a lot of memories in our head that make us react to it.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Stop motion animation is, to me, is something that simultaneously it kind of makes a lot of sense. And then is also the most mysterious form of animation in my mind. You know, so specifically to get kind of in some of the nuts and bolts. So the illusion of life is kind of something the Disney guys talked about pursuing and really kind of achieving, like drawing, you know, frame by frame, creating someone who looks like they're thinking and breathing and feeling. And that's something that makes sense to me in the world of animation, because you can really kind of draw those things frame by frame. But in stop motion, I think there are probably different challenges for creating that illusion of life. And so I guess kind of my question for you is, how do you go about creating a performance in stop motion with a model or a puppet or clay?
Yeah. It's a good question because it's different from other forms of animation in the sense that it's kind of like going on stage and doing a performance with very little rehearsal. And because a stage performance is a one-time thing. It happens and then it's gone. And that's what a piece of stop motion is like, because you have to literally start from frame one and keep going straight ahead. Mm. And then of course you're also dealing with gravity. You know, the puppet may fall over. The puppet, you're dealing with a physical object that's built out of, you know, wire and joints and clay or whatever, you know, and it's a lot of those materials can be very top heavy. And so it's very, you know, your puppet might break, it might fall over, you might bump into a light accidentally. And, you know, so, but in terms of So all kinds of things can go wrong because you don't have the same level of control that you have over 2D or CG, where you animate your keyframes and then you fill the in-betweens in later. So I think that you kind of, as far as creating a performance, I think it's a lot like just thinking and planning as much as possible. One of the things they did on shows like Nightmare Before Christmas and when they started using frame grabbers where they could actually shoot, they could actually see their animation a bit more as they were doing it. Whereas in the old days, you had your camera pointed at your puppet and you were basically shooting in the dark. You had no idea what it was even looking like until you sent the film to the lab and got it back. But once video assist and then computer tech and computer software came in where you could actually see what you're doing and go back and view it and see all your paths and your arcs and check them as you're doing it. And you could even delete a frame if you don't like it. That's given a lot more control to animators over the process, but it also allows you to actually do like a blocking test. Like they would actually do pop throughs where they would animate puppets on like, you know, 10s or 15s or, and just kind of like pop them through a scene, just kind of like move them through.
He's funny.
What are you doing?
I'm shooting fire.
You're crazy.
Huh. Which is kind of the same thing as storyboarding. You know, you storyboard and plan out your layouts and do like a really rough layout of your drawn character before you commit to actually doing the final drawings. So it's the same process. It's the same, you know, if you have the luxury of doing that on a feature film, you would. On a TV series, you might not. And you have to kind of fly by the seat of your pants. But it just comes with practice like anything else. I think it comes from thinking like an actor and playing with the puppet, seeing what kind of poses you can get out of the puppet. And just really, I think, thinking about it and acting it out yourself. Some animators might use video reference. Which I actually did. I actually, because I was schooled in both 2D and stop motion, I would sometimes animate a sequence in with drawings first, just with really scribbly drawing, because it didn't matter what the drawings look like, because I was only using it for reference. And then I would just go back and use my drawn animation as a reference and just try to make the puppet match what each drawing looked like. And then I got really nice fluid, you know. But doing it that way first allowed me to make mistakes in that process and then so that I wouldn't make them later. So, but every animator has a different preference for how they want to plan and whether they act it out in front of a mirror, in front of a camera, things like that.
Huh. Interesting. That's so fascinating. So I'm curious, let's say you do kind of, you do bump a light or you do make a mistake like, oh my gosh, this animation is not really working the way I wanted it to. Do you have to just sort of start over with that action? I mean, can you go back to frame 15 or whatever?
Not really. Not really. I mean, you can try. There are ways that you can kind of, if you realize early on, like in the middle of a shot that you're animating, that this is not going where I want it to go, you might be able to just, if you're brave, you could delete a few frames and, you know, go back to where you were and then kind of keep going. But those frames are then gone forever. Although there's ways that you can hide them and save them for later. But because I learned it on the fly on film where I didn't really have those luxuries of all that kind of stuff, I kind of got used to just flying by the seat of my pants and just, you know, going straight ahead. It's a lot like life. You know, you can't go back. If you do something and make a mistake in life, you can't go, you know, it's not like you have a time machine where you can go back and fix it and then start your life over again from that point, you know?
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a sort of, it's a style of animation where you're always kind of have that pressure over your head where it's like, I only have one shot, like one chance to do this and make it work. But sometimes the puppet kind of has a life of its own and it'll kind of, you kind of have to wrestle with it, but kind of also let it guide you along. And sometimes as you're animating, you might come across a different idea in the middle of your shot and be like, oh, wait a minute. What if it happened if I did this and be open to surprises? And sometimes it'll just work. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes you may need to do a shot over again. I did that a few times too. But you know, it depends. That's why learning it as a student is great, because you usually have the luxury of making mistakes and going back and fixing it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned just the idea of kind of working with the actual puppet and kind of letting it sort of be a part of the process. I remember watching sort of behind the scenes things for Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Honey, I'm 7 non-Fox years old now. My father died at 7 and a half. I don't want to live in a hole anymore, and I'm going to do something about it.
And Wes Anderson talked about how he wanted the sort of finger movements of all the fur, just, you know, the sort of rippling fur that you get just, you know, molding the puppet like you would get in an old King Kong movie. That was something that he sort of leaned into in terms of like, this is going to happen, and I want that. Are there things like that in stop motion? You know, things that you know are part of the medium that you can really lean into. Like if I'm working with clay, I know touching the surface is going to change the surface. Or I'm working in a medium that doesn't naturally have motion blur. Does that change the way you, is that something you take into account in stop motion? Still trying to wrap my head around like the medium itself and where you lean into its attributes.
Yeah, no, that's a good question too. It partly depends on the aesthetic that you're going for. If you're trying to go for really smooth, like, you know, perfect looking animation, you know, clay is not the best medium for that because clay is very unforgiving. But if you want to go after, it's kind of related to, again, the kind of thing I said about how, you know, like the fact that you see, like, you know, that they're little wiggling dolls on the screen that somebody is touching. And so if you see little fingerprints dancing around, or if you see the fur moving around on Mr. Fox or whatever, that doesn't actually take away anything from it. It actually adds to the charm of it. And if a director actually, like Wes Anderson, wants that there, then that kind of takes the pressure off to make it look perfect. The imperfection is part of what gives stop motion that charm. So, I mean, if that's the aesthetic that you want, then it's a lot more forgiving, because then you just kind of expect that the audience will kind of buy into it. It's part of the aesthetic behind it. Whereas other films like Corpse Bride is an example, you know, it's so smooth and so fluid, it almost, you know, looks very similar to computer animation, because they just really amped up the smoothness and the technical quality, and it has a certain beauty and grace to it. But it's a different aesthetic than a film like Fantastic Mr. Fox. It all comes down to kind of, I think the vision of the director will kind of determine, you know, how perfect they want it to look and smooth, and kind of like if they want to hide those blemishes. And digitally now you can. You can actually, a lot of the things that used to be hindrances in stop motion, like if you wanted to make a character fly, you know, back in the days, they would actually suspend puppets on little thin monofilament strings and have them fly through the air and hope that the strings wouldn't show up on camera. Now you can actually have the rig visible in the shot, have a stick holding the puppet up, and you can erase that out digitally. And that's how a lot of animation's done now. So some of the things that used to make stop motion a lot more unforgiving, technology has made some of that easier to do.
Interesting. And you've sort of alluded to this already in some of the things that you've said, but one of the greatest mysteries to me, just in terms of stop motion animation, is timing. And hand-drawn and 3D, you can do an exposure sheet and you can figure out frame 15. This is what, you know, how does that work in stop motion?
Well, you can still use an exposure sheet in stop motion as well. And you can plan it out ahead of time. I talked about this a lot in my books, actually using exposure sheets, because a lot of the techniques kind of crossed over from what I was doing in classical animation. And I just started tried to see if stop motion could do the same thing. So yeah, you can have all of that. You can do pop throughs. You can do, you know, this is when it comes to timing, this is what I always tell, this is what the mantra I would give my students year after year after year. And it's something that I learned as an animator and going to school is that, okay, so if it's 24 frames per second and you're shooting on, assuming that you're shooting on twos, so taking two pictures of every little move that you do, it basically takes, like, my rule of thumb with timing is that it takes 6 frames to feel an action, 8 frames to really see it, and 12 frames for the mind to completely register it and for it to get stuck in the brain. And I tell my students that all the time because they get so wrapped up in this stop motion, this repetitive, you know, move, click, move, click, move, click. It becomes this hypnotic kind of a thing. But you also need to understand that it's not just move, click, move, click, move, click. It's actually slowing your character down, easing them into a hold, and then actually giving them a hold for maybe 8 frames or 12 frames, and then easing out of that hold and into the next pose. But you kind of have to train your brain to think in terms of 24 frames per second. So if you know that there's a movement that you're trying to create on screen, the timing in your world doesn't matter. All that matters is what's on screen. Mm-hmm. And so if you think, okay, so if it takes 6 frames to feel something and it's a quick little action, that means I need to do 3 of those. It's going to take 3 moves just to feel that quick little glance or that quick little action. And in order for people to really see it, I need to do 8 frames. So that's like at least 4 moves. And then if I really want the audience to see this pose or see this action, I'm going to have to do more frames. Maybe it'll be 10 or 12 moves of the puppet. And then maybe I need to ease into a hold. You know, it's the whole principle of learning timing is not something that all animators grasp right away. It came very naturally to me because I grew up as a kid watching a lot of animation on VHS with the pause button and the advanced frame button, and actually looking at, you know, how these motions happened. And I also grew up learning music. And so I learned about timing and meter and measures and whole notes and half notes, and the fact that not every note is exactly the same. You know, some notes are longer, some notes are shorter. So when I started learning animation, it came very naturally to me. It doesn't come naturally to other animators. They have to kind of learn it. They have to come at it a different way. Some animators really struggle with timing. Others don't. But a lot of it just comes down to understanding that, you know, the time frame that's on screen is actually what matters. It might take you 2 hours of your time, but what's on screen is really just going to be like a quick little bloop. With kids, especially, kids don't, when you do stop motion workshops with kids, they don't understand timing at all because you get them through that and they just want to see it play back. And then I play it back at like 12 frames per second or whatever. And they go, it's moving too fast. And I go, well, then you need to do more moves. And I show them how it works. Like I show them, I said, if you want to make it slow, and that's really the most basic thing with stop motion because it is straight ahead. If you want a slow movement, you just need to take more pictures. If it's a fast, snappy, quick action, then the poses of the puppet can be farther apart and you'll get a better effect. So people always ask, you know, how many frames does it take to do a motion? It's like, well, it depends. Is it a fast motion or is it a slow motion? Because the frame rate is consistent. It's how you manipulate the distance between those frames. And particularly with stop motion, it's the distance between all the movements that you're making straight ahead of that puppet, then that's where the timing comes in. And it's just something that you master over time.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That makes sense. And you talked about kind of, even easing into emotion or out of, does stop motion sort of make use of the 12 principles of animation? I mean, Interesting. Okay.
I think so. Yeah. It depends on the medium. I mean, the hardest one to do is, of course, squash and stretch, because most physical puppets don't actually squash and stretch, but you can actually do things like replacement heads that will have like squash and stretch, where it's almost like a hybrid of 2D animation, where instead of a series of drawings that are all different, you have a series of body parts or heads that are all different. And that's one of the ways you can get squash and stretch into stop motion. But things like anticipation, posing, appeal, all that stuff is the same. You know, if a character is going to pick up an object, have them move their hand up before they come down to pick it up. You know, that's anticipation. Arcs are really important. If you don't have arcs and stop motion, that's where you get that kind of jittery kind of King Kong kind of a look that comes about with stop motion, is that everything still moves in arcs. And the software now actually allows you to actually put markers in. So you can actually plot out your arcs and your motion, and you could even draw on the screen and plan out, where's that arc going to be of his hand or his arm moving? And you can have all that as a guide. And then it's just basically moving your puppet to match these little marks that you put in, you know? So it's just, all the principles are exactly the same. But it's a completely different way of doing it, because you're fighting. It's not just a digital thing, character on a screen, or a stack of drawings that you're moving. It's a physical being that is actually, you know, that has all the same temperaments of any kind of anybody who won't do what you want.
Fascinating. Well, that's really interesting. And it certainly makes it sound, that, like, you know, stop motion really is just like any other form of animation, a craft, and those who are good at it, love the craft and really, work on that craft. I'm curious, you know, so for example, to study the history of Disney animation, you know, there are certain tent poles, you know, Steamboat Willie, Flowers and Trees, these Disney pictures came along and changed the game. Three Little Pigs, you know, for whatever, Snow White. I'm curious, you know, in the world of stop motion, what are some of those tentpole films or moments, maybe a moment in a different film that's not animation? What are those things that kind of changed the game in the history of stop motion?
Oh, I like that question, because I did chapters in my books all about the history of stop motion, and I always used to do that, teach that in my classes. So gosh, I haven't really given much thought to like what the tentpole films would be, but a few of them definitely come to mind. I mean, I think you'd have to start with King Kong. This is the thing though about the history of stop motion, is that it actually has two tributaries to it. So when stop motion started off, it was kind of a novelty. So the tentpole film would have been like a movie like The Automatic Moving Company or Bewitched Matchsticks, where they would just move matches around or move furniture around. And it was really more like pixelation. It was like object animation. Huh. Then in Russia, there was a filmmaker named Ladislav Starovich, who was kind of like the Disney of stop motion, because he was the first person. Walt Disney was the guy who came along and basically said, okay, like, I think we can actually use this medium to tell stories with real characters rather than just, you know, moving drawings and bouncing cats. That kind of was the novelty of moving drawings. But he actually said, why don't we take it a step further? So Starovich was the one who did that for stop motion as a puppet animator. He made a lot of different films. The Cameraman's Revenge was probably the first tentpole film that he did, because it was all, he was also an entomologist. So he actually collected dead insects and beetles and butterflies. And he sort of put two and two together that, you know, if you put wires inside these actual dead bugs, you could move them frame by frame on camera. And so he made this film about these little stop motion insects moving around, and people thought that he had trained them, like he got like a wizard to train these bugs to move and act on camera. So that's puppet animation, where the puppets are the only thing you see on screen and they kind of live in a miniature world. But there's another form of animation, which I call creature effects, which is what King Kong really started. King Kong was the first stop motion character, and they actually released a lot of false information about how it was done because they kept it as a closely guarded secret.
Oh, wow.
That was all done, you know, like King Kong himself was only about 12 inches high, but on screen he was made to look huge because they also, it wasn't just a revolutionary film in terms of the animation effects, but also the compositing, like the matte painting and how they would create these mats, you know, like these backgrounds and composite the puppet into the screen. And then you'd have the little actors, you know, looking tiny on the screen because they're projected onto the set a frame at a time. These really wacky techniques, right? So it was revolutionary, not just for stop motion, but for film. But beyond that, King Kong was an actual character. Like, you actually cared about him and you felt for him at the end of the movie, you know? Huh. And then that, of course, got Ray Harryhausen, who was, Willis O'Brien was the guy who did the effects for King Kong. Ray Harryhausen took it a step further and made creature effects like Jason and the Argonauts and the Sinbad films. And then in the 80s, you had tons of movies like the Star Wars and Willow and the Terminator, you know, like all those movies had stop motion in them. Because if you wanted a dinosaur or a creature or a robot or a monster in the film, especially one that was supposed to look huge, you did it in stop motion. That was the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. But the tentpole film that stopped the creature effects medium or the creature effects use of stop motion was Jurassic Park, because they were originally going to do stop motion dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. But then computer animation had gotten to a point where they could actually do some tests and make dinosaurs that were a lot more realistic. And when Spielberg saw that, he said, like, this is where this, forget stop motion, this is the way we have to go. But the same year that Jurassic Park came out, 1993, The Nightmare Before Christmas also came out the same year.
It's as real as my skull, and it does exist. Here, let me show you.
And that was the first, no, it wasn't the first stop motion feature film ever made. A lot of people think it was. But it was actually the first one to receive worldwide distribution. Before that, stop motion feature length films were very kind of spotty, few and far between from different countries. But that was the first one that actually had a Disney level, like, because it was Disney owned it because Tim Burton wrote the story while he was an animator working on Fox and the Hound. So they owned it. And so they now, and because Tim Burton now was, you know, Mr. Batman, they said, oh, he's a big time director. Let's bring him back and make this film. So that, the fact that that movie came out the same year when the creature effects kind of river basically came to an end, the puppet animation river kept going, and it actually even got better because of the digital tools that allowed animators more control. The only other tentpole film I can think of is actually a TV series, and that was Gumby, because Gumby was the first show that brought clay animation to the forefront. And then Will Vinton took it a step further when he made a film called Closed Mondays, which was the first stop motion film to win the Academy Award for Best Animated Short. In fact, they changed the name of the category from Best Cartoon to Best Animated Short because of Closed Mondays, because it wasn't a cartoon, because it wasn't drawing. It was actually clay figures moving. And they said, what do we call this? We said, well, we'll call it an animated short. So... Anyway, I think those are some of the tentpole films in the history of it.
That's fascinating. That's really interesting. One of the things that I think unfortunate in general is that when there is something new or different, that people seem to be quick to say that the old is dead. Right. So when 3D animation comes out, oh, hand drawn is dead. It's dead. We don't need, you know, it's dead. I'm sure we said the same probably.
That went on for years.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, in as much as hand drawn has received that and probably to some extent still does, it's probably worse for stop motion animation. You have these big studios like Aardman and Leica who I think are keeping stop motion animation kind of in the forefront of the people's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But it, it's clearly not dead as an art form. Can you talk about just sort of, I mean, you've alluded to some of this in with the draw of stop motion, but even some of like what stop motion is sort of bringing to the world of animation. I mean, when I watched, for instance, Kubo and the Two Strings, which is an incredible film, it very nearly looks three-dimensional in terms of it's digitally created. And there are elements, I'm sure, but it's a stop motion film. And with craft of, we're going to make different heads and different mouth positions and things. Can you just talk about sort of, I don't want to say stop motion fight to stay in the game, because I don't think that's necessarily true, but really just, I guess, the relevance of stop motion animation even today.
Yeah, well, you know, it kind of, it's part of it is looking at it from the perspective of, you know, like big name studio films that everyone and their brother and sister kind of knows about versus the more independent shorts or features, which are actually getting a lot more love now because the way that we watch movies has changed. So with streaming, and streaming services and distribution and you know, going to the theater is kind of a bit of a touch and go thing right now because of the pandemic. It's hard to say, you know, the way we consume entertainment has also changed. And so I think stop motion gets a bit more of a shot at things when there's other avenues that kind of open up for actually, how do you actually see it? Because I'm part of this sort of animation world, and I've gone to a lot of animation festivals, and I've met a lot of people in the industry, and not just people who work at the big name studios, but people who work for maybe a smaller studio that, you know, most people never heard about. So I'm constantly telling people about animated films that I know about, and the people in the animation circles and the people who follow animation websites know about, but your average person that you might see at church or at school, you know, probably have no idea. It's like, well, let me tell you, you know, I'm notorious for recommending weird, obscure films to people because I get frustrated that nobody knows because God, this is so beautiful. You need to see this. But, you know, it at the end of the day, though, it's also all about a really good story. And it's also different aesthetics, too. Like Leica has a certain aesthetic where they've kind of gone a lot more towards like hybrid. It's stop motion, but they do a lot more hybrid with computer effects. And it's also, they actually do a lot of 3D printing. So a lot of that animation is actually animated in the computer. And then they have a 3D printer that prints out every, like thousands and thousands of, it's mostly in the facial animation. Like the body itself is just a one puppet that they animate. And you know, God help me, I don't know how some of the animators there get some of the fluid motion that they get. But the faces are all like animated in a computer ahead of time. And then each face is printed out with a 3D printer. And then they just attach that face onto the puppet for every frame. So some of it's kind of CG, but it's actually like bringing what you can do in CG into the physical world. It'd be like if you could print out your computer animation, which is literally what they're doing. They're printing out their computer animation. And that's why it has that look. But then they might mash it up with, you know, certain effects that are actually more, maybe more digital. They do a lot more digital compositing. So they are kind of in this really high level technical kind of a thing. But then you compare that to someone like Wes Anderson, who I absolutely adore. He's one of my favorite filmmakers, whether it's a stop motion film or not. And he makes a film like Fantastic Mr. Fox or Isle of Dogs, which is a completely different aesthetic because the textures and everything feels handcrafted. I mean, even a movie like Moonrise Kingdom feels handcrafted. Because that's his aesthetic. That's just how he makes his films. So his style of filmmaking matches that really, really well. There's a fantastic stop motion film on Netflix right now, which came out only about a month ago, called The House. And if you haven't seen it, it's absolutely fantastic. It's kind of like if Wes Anderson and David Lynch got together over a couple glasses of scotch and decided to make a film together. But it has, it's made by, it's some of the same people who worked on Mr. Fox are involved with it. So some of the puppets have, it's actually an anthology. So there's three different stories done by three different stop motion filmmakers, and they each have their own style. Like one of them is actually, puppets are all made out of felt. And you can actually see the felt moving on their faces as they move.
Huh.
And then where there's another story where the puppets are a lot more Mr. Fox-ish, like they're like real fur, real cat fur kind of a look. But then Henry Selick also has a stop motion film coming out on Netflix called Wendell and Wild, which the trailer hasn't been released yet, but there's been some images. And then, Guillermo del Toro is finally making his stop motion version of Pinocchio, which they just released a trailer. So 2022 is actually one of those years. Like, this is the thing about stop motion features, is that every few years, there's like 1 year where there'll be like four or five stop motion films that come out all in the same year. And this is another one of those years. The last time it happened, I think, was when like Curse of the Were-Rabbit and Corpse Bride came out within the same year, you know? So, I mean, that's because stop motion takes longer to do. And it's kind of done more by people on the fringe. It's not done by the big, you know, Disney, Pixar, DreamWorks places. It's done by the people on the fringe, and that's why you don't see it as much. But when you see it, it's usually a great thing, because it is, like you said, something new, it's something different. And people will either wake up to it or they won't, or it'll become a cult film and they'll discover it over time, even if the box office isn't good. But again, if it's a good story, it doesn't matter what medium it's in.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. That is true. That's one of the things I've learned. I'm a big fan of Genndy Tartakovsky's Samurai Jack. And one of the things I learned just watching that show is, and they have incredible, incredible artwork, but their characters are all very minimally, simply designed. And it taught me that, like, it's not how you draw, it's what you do with how you draw. And I'm sure it's the same with any kind of medium in animation. Like, it's not how you animate, but what you do with how you animate. Stop motion.
Yeah.
Being a part
it's of a it. Combination of really good character design and really good story, and not just really good character design, but appealing character design. And appeal doesn't necessarily mean, you know, cute, or it's not just for the heroic characters. Like, villains can be appealing as well. In a lot of cases, villains are more appealing.
Yeah, that's true. mentioned Wes Anderson, and I love Fantastic Mr. Fox. I think it's a great picture, and I'm astounded with the level of control that he appears to have over any movie he makes, but that one especially. But it was kind of sort of fun thing to learn that behind the scenes, as they were making this film, one of the things I guess they didn't realize until they had shot all this footage was that the humidity in the room with the set was changing over time, and the increments in what that was doing to the set was so minimal that they didn't see it until they went back and watched all this footage, and suddenly their set is sort of breathing and kind of moving around.
Yeah.
As it should not be. That I think is something that, gosh, how easy to overlook is that?
yeah.
You know, so I guess the question, I wanted to ask is, you know, are there kind of general precautions when you're setting out on a feature film for stop motion that, like, this is what we have to do to ensure that that doesn't happen?
Oh yeah. There's a lot more cautions, because it's not like, it's not like computer animation where it's in a digital box, you know, it's the real world, and the real world does things, especially over time. There was a funny story about when they were shooting, I think it was King Kong, they actually tried putting real plants on the set, and they realized that was a bad idea because they would either wilt under the hot lights or they would blossom.
And oh, wow.
They play it back and be like, oh, wait a minute. It takes a long time for plants to grow and die. So kind of, you know, these plants kind of moving over like time-lapse photography, right? Yeah, I mean, I tell things like this, these precautionary things to, I would tell a lot of this to students that I would teach as well, especially for the Academy of Art, because those courses were all online. So I actually wasn't, they had to actually set up, the way the school had it set up is they would do animation in their apartment or wherever. And then I would just look at what they did and tell them, you know, how to make it better. For some reason, a lot of them didn't understand that the camera is not supposed to move. That's number one. Everything needs to be locked down really, really tight, except for the thing that you're animating. And then of course the thing that you're animating, if it needs to be tied down, you know, you can tie down its feet to the set so that its feet don't move and you can move the rest of it, but so it doesn't fall over. But that being said, you know, your whole environment really has to be completely controlled. You can't animate in a room with windows, because if there's sunlight coming in through the windows, then you'll have shadows moving and time lapse across your set. Mm-hmm. You do have to control, and this is more important on a feature film, because on a feature film, it's done over months and months and months. Whereas most students are not making a feature film. They're just making like an assignment or a short film. And in those cases, that whole like warping of the wooden sets, and because the reason that would happen in feature films is because the sets are all built on these like wooden platforms, and wood especially warps over time. And that's one of the things, the problems that they would have on feature films. But really just, you know, making sure that your lights are tied down, that your set is tied down, that your camera is tied down, and you have to give yourself kind of enough room to maneuver around your set without bumping into your light or bumping into your camera. Even your floor, it's better if you're in an apartment or a room that has like a wooden or a concrete floor, because if you have a floor that warps as you walk around, that's also going to cause, because your tripod's attached to the floor, right? So if your floor moves as you're walking, that's also going to affect the camera moving ever so slightly. So I always tell people, you know, like, don't wear shoes, move around, or at least at the very least stand in the same spot every time when you hit that capture button. And then you go back to your set and you move your puppet, and then you go back to that spot where you were, because you have to be out of the frame as well. And your shadow has to be out of the frame. I did a shot when I was in college. I did a film where I was animating this animated character scooting around across the floor. And I would actually like to crouch over on my knees and go over there, move the puppet, and then move back over to the side of the room where the camera was, take the picture. And then I would crawl over to the puppet, move the puppet, crawl back to the camera, take the picture, but I didn't move back far enough. So my shadow was actually in the frame, in the corner of the frame, dancing around like this, because my shadow was actually in the frame. And because it was on film, I couldn't see that. So there's all kinds of stuff. It also helps to wear black, because black absorbs light. So if you wear light colors, that will reflect light onto your set, and it'll cause fluctuations in the light and how light is bouncing off your puppet. And that will show up on camera when you play it back. So there's all kinds of stuff you got to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a animator friend I work with from time to time. He likes to call those moments like gotcha moments. Like, what's the gotcha, right? Like, aha, gotcha. Yeah. You know, here's a little, it sounds like there are plenty of those opportunities in stop motion. Ah, gotcha. You were white.
It's the universe kind of conspiring against you to, you know, make your life miserable.
So what do you tell students who are interested in going into stop motion as a career, or who are really interested in that? What's the advice there?
Well, the best advice is that careers in stop motion are almost very, very few and far between. There's very few, like, there's tons of people who can go after careers in, 2D or 3D animation, because that's where most productions are done that way. And there's whole schools and there's whole programs, including the one at Van Arts where I still work, that, trains people for that industry, because that's where the jobs are. There's not a lot of jobs in stop motion. I tried for years to get into, to do more studio work. And I would get that question a lot. But it really comes down to just, you have to be really passionate about it, and you have to just really, but the nice thing about it is that you don't need to, it doesn't need to be a career. It could be a hobby. It could be an independent filmmaker role. There's a lot of animators who actually do, they get a job, like their career, like their day job might be in computer animation or 2D animation, but they could, that doesn't stop them from making a stop motion film on the side. Actually, a lot of buddies of mine who are in doing amazing stop motion have day jobs in a video game studio or in a computer animation house, right? So that's what puts bread on the table, but you can still make a stop motion film in your garage, in your apartment. And just that's really, if you want to do stop motion, I think that's really where you have to consider that that's probably what you're going to be doing. And if you keep doing that, but then, if you're lucky, then there are studios that do it. It might mean you might move to somewhere else where there's more of it being done. But if you're willing to do that, doors could open. The best way to open doors, and I tell students this all the time, is go to animation festivals. It's harder now because most of them are virtual. But if we ever get to a point where they can be meeting more in person again, because like that's how the job that I got at Academy of Art came about. It was through someone I met at an animation festival. Who happened to work with somebody I was there with, it's like, because people know people, and if they like you, they'll remember you. And the animation field is one where people move around a lot. They don't generally tend to stay at one studio for a long time. So you might meet someone who's working at a place at that given time, but then even 5 years later, they might be doing something else and working someplace else. And then they got put in a stop motion project falls into their lap. And then they remember you, like, whoa, well, and that's actually one of the neat things, is that because stop motion animators are so kind of few and far between, and it's almost like a little secret club. If a stop motion project comes up, and if they remember you as the stop motion guy, that's who they're going to think of. Whereas they could think of dozens and hundreds of people that do computer animation, because especially here in Vancouver, you could throw a rock and hit a 3D animator or a 2D animator. Whereas a stop motion animator is a lot harder to find, and it's a lot harder to find a good one. So the best advice is just keep doing it and make relationships with people in the industry, because that's how those opportunities will come about. And they might not always come about the way you want them to or when you expect them to, but that's a lot of things about life are like that too.
So. Yeah.
But you can also make a film and just put it on YouTube. You don't even have to throw it. You don't even have to enter it into film festivals. You can just throw it on YouTube and see what happens.
Yeah, that's interesting. It reminds me, I don't know a lot about Aardman Studio and their history, but reading an interview with a director who was talking with them, it sounded like they just kind of started in a basement working on short film. And now they're Aardman Studio. So
yeah, that's how they got started. It was Peter Lorre and David Sproxton were just two British schoolboys who liked Ray Harryhausen movies and said, hey, we should do that. That's how things start. Even Walt Disney started in a garage in a farm in Missouri or somewhere, or Kansas, I don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Getting low on time here. So I did want to ask you personally, it sounds like you are, far more stop motion animation projects than I do, which is cool. But I'm curious, like, do you have a What are some of your favorite kind of stop motion animated shorts or feature films?
Oh, wow. Well, we've talked about Mr. Fox a lot, which I also adore. The Nightmare Before Christmas is my favorite animated film ever.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot of short films I've seen throughout the years. The only ones that come to mind are like Balance, which is a German stop motion film from the late 80s. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube now. It's pretty common. Creature Comforts was the short film that Nick Park did, which kind of grew into a TV series, is also absolutely amazing. I don't know. I like a lot of weird stuff. I like a lot of, there's some Eastern European kind of stuff that is sometimes kind of cool. Jan Svankmajer's Alice is a great film. It's a really creepy, disturbing version of Alice in Wonderland. The only adaptation of Alice where the white rabbit bleeds sawdust and pulls his clock out of his chest cavity. Gosh. Yeah, I don't know. There's so many. I love Wallace and Gromit still, because that's really what kind of got me started with it. But the most recent stop motion film I've seen, which totally blew me away, is The House. I absolutely loved it.
Let's look it up.
Stop motion usually tends to gravitate towards the dark, creepy kind of stuff, you know. I think it has to do with its puppetry roots, but also just the fact that stop motion is mostly done by really lonely people in dark corners who don't go outside very much. So that's why, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, dark, creepy films made in stop motion. There's a really creepy one called The Sandman. If you want to have nightmares for years, it was actually an animator named Paul Berry who worked on Nightmare Before Christmas, and he got hired to be on the Nightmare team because of this stop motion film he made called The Sandman from like the early 90s. And it's don't show it to your kids. It will haunt you for the rest of your life. But it's awesome. It's actually beautifully done. Huh. But it's scary.
Yeah, I'm sure this is a common thing you hear. I was mildly disturbed when I watched Coraline. I thought, my gosh, what's going on here?
Oh, that's a favorite too. Yeah. Well, anything that, if it's written by Neil Gaiman, you know, it's not going to be, you know, Little House on the Prairie to begin with.
Yeah.
That's a scary film, but it's brilliantly done. But it's the story and the medium of stop motion that makes that work. And it's just the kind of story that you couldn't tell that particular story in any medium other than stop motion, maybe 2D, but if it was a very stylized version of 2D, but like Neil Gaiman actually wrote the book because he saw Nightmare Before Christmas and he hoped that Henry Selick would make it into a film.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
But when you're Neil Gaiman, you have that kind of power.
Sure. Yeah. It's an actual possibility. Like, this might happen.
Yeah. He wrote it for him.
Wow. Really.